Today is Thursday, March 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
This particular tanker was just north of Libya when it took on board a group of some 100 migrants.
That's reporter Catherine Field. We'll have the full story coming up. Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump says Russia has to get out of Venezuela. And 10 million Afghans are in urgent need of help after floods and drought. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump says Russia has to get out of Venezuela following the recent arrival of Russian military personnel in that country. Details from VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
The president was asked by a reporter if he's willing to back up his demand to Moscow with U.S. boots on the ground in Venezuela.
All options are open, yeah.
Trump adds that Moscow is well aware of the U.S. stance. He spoke to reporters on Wednesday in the Oval Office alongside Fabiana Rosales, the wife of Venezuelan opposition leader and self-declared interim president Juan Guaido, recognized by the United States and dozens of other countries. Guaido in Venezuela on Wednesday called on supporters on Saturday to protest against nationwide power outages. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Well, five migrants were arrested in Malta after they took control of a merchant ship that had rescued them and more than 100 others in the Mediterranean. A Maltese Special Operations Unit of the nation's armed forces stormed the ship early this morning. 12 children and 19 women were among the migrants. The migrants were rescued by the ship off the coast of Libya and refused to return to Tripoli. The captain of the rescue ship said he and his crew were threatened and were ordered to take the migrants to Malta or Italy. However, Italy would not allow the migrants to disembark in Italy. I spoke with a reporter, Catherine Field, about the incident and if the hijacking is a signal of a trend of more drastic measures being taken by migrants.
This particular tanker was just north of Libya when it took on board a group of some 100 migrants who had been in the area, who'd been trying to make it to either Malta or to Italy. Then you were stormed by these migrants who took control of the vessel. And eventually it was brought into Maltese waters, and it was there that special forces went aboard and took back control of the vessel.
Why did something like this happen now?
There are several reasons. One is that we're coming into the calmer weather period in Europe. It's coming into the spring, so more migrants are attempting to make that crossing across the Mediterranean. Another reason that is being put about is that the so-called Operation Sophia, that's the European Union's coast guard that operates ships within the Mediterranean that picks up and assists migrants, that operation is going to be curtailed in the next couple of days. That whole operation will now continue without naval ships, but will just have air surveillance. So it's felt that these migrants perhaps felt that this was the only possibility that they would have for being able to get to Malta. Let's not forget, a lot of people have been dying in the Mediterranean. Last year, 2,300 died, 290 the year before. These are people that weren't picked up by these so-called rescue vessels. So people are surmising now that if there are no vessels there to pick up these migrants, that they're going to take more extreme measures and start hijacking any vessel that is in the area.
Well, hijacking vessels is certainly not going to gain them a lot of sympathy. For instance, Italy, I understand, is not going to allow them there. So what is going to happen to these migrants?
Well, they will be processed as per all the other migrants who have come in, and they will either be allowed to come and stay in Europe or they will be sent back. And this is really one of the criteria that the European Union says. That's why they set up the EU Emergency Trust for Africa. This is a fund which gives money, actually, to these migrants to go home. It has already given funding for some 60,000 would-be migrants to return to their homes in Africa, and that's on top of more than 5 million would-be migrants who have received basic support for staying in their home countries. So it's a very complicated picture, especially as you rightly say, Italy has said it will not let ships dock at its ports, And you've also got NGOs such as Amnesty International, who has said, look, all this is the fault of EU governments who will not take responsibility for these migrants. You've got other NGOs such as Mediterranea, who used to have a rescue ship in the Mediterranean, saying that these countries such as the European Union are just turning their back on fundamental rights. They are just turning their backs on human beings that are fleeing. So it's a very complicated picture, and particularly with the EU now saying it's going to curb its assistance for these migrants, because essentially what that means is these migrants will now be forced to either stay in Libya or be taken back to Libya. And there it is known that the centres for processing and for these places where migrants are held really do fall short on international standards of well-being and how you treat would-be migrants.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump renews his threat to close the southern U.S. border. Contending Mexico and three Central American countries are not doing anything to halt the surge of undocumented migrants. Chinese President Xi Jinping signs lucrative deals while in Paris in an attempt to build relations with the EU. And the leader of Australia's far-right One Nation Party is under fire after she was captured on camera suggesting a deadly mass shooting that led to the country's strict gun control laws was part of a conspiracy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using a special instrument on the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope Interferometer were able to observe the complex atmosphere of an exoplanet 129 light-years from Earth. The exoplanet, called HR 8799e, was discovered in 2010. It's considered to be a super Jupiter that's only 30 million years old and has a temperature of about 1,000 degrees Celsius. The high temperature is thought to be from leftover energy from its formation and a greenhouse effect produced by its atmosphere, which the astronomers say is filled with clouds of iron and silicates that churn in a global storm. The instrument used to make the observations is called Gravity. The device combines the signals of the four telescopes of the Very Large Telescope Array to create a super telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
An international relief agency warns an estimated 10 million people in Afghanistan, more than a quarter of its population, face severe acute food insecurity and are in need of urgent life-saving humanitarian assistance in the wake of recent floods and drought. 3 years of drought have contributed to massive crop failure, economic hardship, hunger and loss of life, and forced 266,000 people from their homes. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society said this today. In the month of March, it noted extreme weather deepened the hardship when above normal rain and snow fell on soil with limited vegetation or ability to soak up the water, bringing flash floods to 9 provinces in Afghanistan. The calamity killed 63 people and displaced at least 281,000 people to makeshift camps with inadequate services. Well, a senior U.S. official warns that prospects for salvaging the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty are dimming as Russia continues to violate the accord. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A last-minute reprieve for the INF Treaty appears increasingly unlikely. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Nonproliferation Christopher Ford says the time for Russia to take the steps necessary for rescuing this treaty is shrinking dramatically and depressingly.
We are doing nothing but responding to an ongoing and persisting pattern of Russian violations of the treaty, things to which the United States has been drawing attention and trying to engage with Russia for many years now, across two different administrations of different political flavors, and in something on the order of 30 different diplomatic engagements with our counterparts in Moscow.
Washington says it will withdraw from the INF treaty by August if Moscow does not fulfill its obligations. The Cold War era pact has been a pillar of European security for more than 30 years. It bans the development and deployment of ground-launched nuclear missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. Europe is fearful of the rupture of the treaty. It has called on both the United States and Russia to remain constructively engaged in trying to preserve it. Ford says all efforts to turn Russia's violations around have proved futile. Russia says it strictly observes the treaty's provisions and does not allow violations. Ford finds one bright spot in the midst of these bilateral nuclear disputes. He says both the United States and Russia are complying with the essential limits of the START, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. This accord limits each side to 1,550 strategic nuclear warheads. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, Thailand's election commission said today the pro-army Prolong Pacharat Party won the popular vote in Sunday's general election with 8.4 million votes. Although the results represent all the ballots counted, the tally remains unofficial until final results are revealed on May 9th. The commission has not announced the full number of seats for each party in the 500-seat House of Representatives. A government led by the incumbent prime minister may start as a minority, but it would likely to try to entice members from the opposition to switch sides. Without a majority in parliament, his government would struggle to pass any laws. Well, more than 100 of the Chibok schoolgirls remain in captivity nearly 5 years after Boko Haram militants in Nigeria abducted them from their school. President Muhammadu Buhari has promised to make the rescue of the girls and other abductees a top priority. Some have been released, but advocacy groups say Buhari's government, in its focus on the economy, has largely forgotten the girls who are still being held. Timothy Abiezu reports from Abuja.
The last time Charity Job saw her daughter, Awa, was on the morning of April 14, 2014, when the girl left for school in Chibok. Awa was among the 276 girls who were abducted later that day by Boko Haram and one of the 112 still in captivity. The insurgents came and took our children, including mine and those of my relatives, from their school. Some of us developed high blood pressure and died as a result of the incident. We that survived, we have children. If I die, who will take care of them? The Chibok mass abduction in 2014 triggered a global outcry and sparked the creation of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, PBOG, in Nigeria. Today, parents of the girls like Sule Kwari still hope their children will return home one day. We've been coming from time to time to search for our girls. Sometimes when we come, we have to wait for the sun to go down. And some people faint from the heat, and sometimes we go back very starved, he says. Advocacy group PBOG says the government is not doing enough to ensure the release of the remaining girls. Although the group has been seeing fewer numbers at its rallies, coordinator Gapani Yanga says they will not relent until the government takes action.
Since the 106 Chibok girls are released, we have not heard anything from the from federal government. Federal government have to stand up, have to stand up to their responsibility.
In October 2016, Nigeria's government secured the safe release of some 21 girls. Another 82 were released in May 2017. Al-Kassim Abdulkadir is spokesperson of the Presidential Committee on the Northeast Initiative. He says the committee is negotiating the release of more girls.
I'm sure very soon we'll reach a middle ground where some of the abductees will be released to their families and to the society at large.
In 2015, then-candidate Buhari promised the release of the abducted Chibok girls and others taken by Boko Haram would be his top priority. As the girls' abduction nears its fifth anniversary, advocates say it is time Buhari puts their rescue at the top of his agenda again. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
This is VOA's International Edition.
voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
U.S. President Donald Trump awarded the military's highest award for valor, the Medal of Honor, to U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Travis W. Atkins, who died in Iraq in 2007 while shielding his fellow soldiers from a suicide attack. Trump presented the medal to Atkins' son, Trevor Oliver, at the White House yesterday. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more on the life and sacrifice of one American service member.
It's always hard. You know, I think about him on a daily basis.
Trevor Oliver was just 10 years old when his father, Army Staff Sergeant Travis Atkins, deployed to Iraq for a second time.
He was a very, very strong person. He had the most courage I know out of anybody. And yeah, no, he was a very, very loving father and the blueprint of a soldier.
The Army was Atkins' calling. On the battlefield, men like former Staff Sergeant Stuart Hollingsworth thought of him as a big brother who always led by example.
You know, as he's asking you to do things, he was already doing it.
But ahead of his second deployment, his father, Jack Atkins, a Vietnam veteran himself, urged him to switch to a less risky Army assignment.
You wouldn't hear of it. He said, Dad, I'm infantry. That's where I belong. That's who I am.
On June 1st, 2007, Atkins and his squad encountered two insurgents in Iraq. Atkins fought in hand-to-hand combat, wrapping his arms around one of them and slamming him to the ground. Atkins then positioned his body as a human shield and braced for what was next. Former Sergeant Sandeo saw the fight from the gun turret of their vehicle.
It was obvious he knew what was coming. It turned out to be a grenade detonated suicide vest, and he had that split second where his instinct took over and he sacrificed himself to protect myself and the others who were present.
To his battle buddies Hollingsworth and Ayo, no one is more deserving of this revered award.
You know, there's gallantry, intrepidude, another fancy term that they like to use when describing these things, and he's every bit of that and more.
Travis was a true hero. He was an American hero. I hope that he's looking down and, you know, can see that I'm trying to make the best of the opportunity that he gave me.
To his mother, Elaine Atkins, and the family, the Medal of Honor means nothing compared to the honor and respect of Atkins' fellow soldiers. Respect for the way he lived, the way he served, the way he made the ultimate sacrifice.
I'm grateful he did the job that he did and that he saved those young men. He was a good soldier, and he did what he needed to do.
The medal, they say, brings closure for a sacrifice not forgotten by a grateful nation. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
A group of experts meeting for the first time to examine the pros and cons of human genome editing says it would be irresponsible to engage in this procedure at this time. Lisa Schlein again reports for VOA.
Late last year, a Chinese scientist created an international storm when he announced he had created the first gene-edited babies. He said he had edited the DNA of the twin girls to protect them from HIV. The WHO panel warns this procedure is too risky and should not be attempted before a system of strong rules governing this technique are established. Co-chair of the advisory committee, Margaret Hamburg, says the group has agreed on a set of core principles. She says the panel recommends WHO create a registry for human genome editing research. Under this system, she says scientific work in these technologies would be registered in a transparent way.
We think it's very important to establish this registry to get a better sense of the research that's going on around the world, greater transparency about it, and in fact, greater accountability in terms of assuring that research meets standards in terms of science and ethics.
The experts agree this would preclude the kind of secrecy that surrounded the work of the Chinese scientist. She says the panel would like this transparency to extend to the publication of manuscripts that emerge from important research. She says publishers will be asked to ensure the research has been registered with WHO before it is publicized. Hamburg says developing the guidelines on human genome editing is a process that will take about 18 months to complete. She says it is a difficult but urgent task that must be carried out in a thoughtful, comprehensive manner. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, Abigail Adams Greenway is from the eastern U.S. state of Pennsylvania, and Masood Umari is from Afghanistan. Together, they make beautiful music, blending classical eastern beats with western style. VOA's Carol Pearson narrates the story.
I think that it's a very big deal culturally what we're doing to bring these, especially Afghanistan and America, together in music, because music speaks all languages.
Greenway and her teacher and musical partner Masood Umari play tabla, an Eastern percussion instrument, every day in Greenway's basement outside Washington. They call this colorfully decorated studio Tabla Sphere.
We play three different kinds of music. We play classical music, and we play traditional music of Afghanistan and India, and we play new music for the new world, we call it. It's our signature music, and it is composed by Masood. It's for two tabla players.
Greenway from Erie, Pennsylvania, and Umari from Kabul, Afghanistan, met 8 years ago at an Afghan antique and textile shop in Washington.
And I realized that he was this amazing tabla player, and I asked for lessons. I didn't know at the time where this was going. All I knew is that I had a huge desire and a force pushing me to learn to play the instrument.
Greenway had a career in visual arts and has been a lifelong lover of all kinds of music. Coming to tabla has been a natural evolution for her.
When I saw first Abigail, she doesn't understand the language of Afghanistan. She understands the beat and melody. She was very exciting to learn, and she learned quickly.
I felt this amazing challenge, and I wanted to play the music. I just couldn't. I wasn't getting there fast enough for me. You know, I wanted to get there now. I practiced many, many hours. I practice every day.
Greenway has also learned to play harmonium from Umari.
I never thought I would be playing the harmonium, so I had my first lesson on the harmonium. I fell in love with it.
After devoting years to intense study and practice, the duo formed Tabla for Two. Umari fled Afghanistan when he was 15 and resettled in Islamabad. There he studied tabla and received his mastership before coming to the U.S. in 2002.
But what's really extraordinary is that Masood is singing and playing tabla at the same time. That is exciting.
The duo plays at embassies, museums, universities, and at the Tabla Sphere for special invited guests. They also have videos on their YouTube channel.
I believe that I have an important role playing and preserving the music of my country, Afghanistan, and sharing it with the world.
It's just the beginning. I've just started learning about a place that I knew nothing about that has been so ravaged, and I'm thrilled to show Afghanistan in a positive, beautiful light.
For producer Jun So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Tian Wang, and I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.